Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
This is Mike Friedenberg, being very honored to fill in for Bob Siegel on the Bob Siegel Show this evening, and very honored to have a great guest on with me this evening, Ryan Holland of CGM. I guess that's Cross Global Media. Is that correct, Ryan?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, cool. So we've got a great show lined up for you today, and you know, a topic it's not going to go away in the near future is unfortunately COVID-19. I'd love to see it disappear off the radar, but it's still here. It's hanging around. They can't seem to get rid of it. We now have, I guess, three functioning vaccines out there. A recent study came out suggesting that we've had over 100 million Americans have had it already. We've had big, gigantic studies come out, like the one done for, Switzerland, or was it was Sweden? But anyway, it was a Danish study, I guess. Anyway, that showed that the masks aren't really working, yet we're now talking about going from a single mask to a double mask. I was just on the phone with somebody, a colleague, the other day, and they had just gotten their first shot. And what they were telling me said, yeah, you're getting this vaccination, but, you know, it may only last 3 months, so you might have to come back in 3 months to get another shot, another vaccine. Meanwhile, the CDC side is saying, hey, if you've had COVID-19, make sure you rush up to get the vaccine because you really desperately need the vaccine. So if you had COVID-19, come and get the vaccine. I can tell you this is unlike any other disease we've ever faced. Or maybe it's not so much that it's unlike every other disease we've ever faced, but that it's being handled unlike any other disease we've ever faced. And, of course, the science and the data supports this approach, right? Right? The science and the data supports it. Or perhaps whenever we hear the term science and data, we should run the other direction knowing it has nothing to do with science, nothing to do with the data. So now we're talking about, you know, pushing this idea of a double mask, but apparently Fauci just came out with a new idea. Along with a mask, you now need to wear nylon hosiery on your face. What you do is you put the mask on and you put like a nylon over your head so that the mask tightens to your face, across your face. And that's the new standard there. And if you don't do that, folks, you don't care about other people. You're probably almost a murderer by not being willing to do this, despite all the science and the data showing that, you know, large population-based studies showing that the masking is either minimally effective or not effective at all. We're supposed to, you know, now buy into wearing double masks and then cinching it on our face using nylon hosiery. So if your wife has any old nylons, you can just use those. You know, this is craziness here. And there's so much disinformation and misinformation out there and outright lies. You know, starting from the very beginning when Anthony Fauci said, hey, masks don't do anything, don't wear them. Now, the reason he was saying that, he admitted later on, is that they did not want people rushing out to buy the N95 class masks. Well, strangely enough, of all the masks out there, the surgical masks and the cloth masks, well, the actual respirators, the N95 masks, actually are the ones that actually do something. So if you're going to go visit a high-risk older relative, don't wear a cloth mask. Don't wear a surgical mask. Yeah, if you have to visit them and you want to be in there for an extended period of time, you might want to wear an N95 mask. Well, that's exactly the mask that at the very beginning of this crisis, Fauci said did not work. So he was lying to you then, and he knew he was lying to you, and he admitted it effectively down the road. So the masks are right now far more a sign of compliance than they are of science. It's about compliance. It's not about science. Of course, there are cases. You know, if you want to talk to somebody and they're 2 feet away from you and you want to avoid spitting on them and you want to have a long conversation with somebody, sure, a mask would stop you from, you know, having the large droplets. But these cloth masks and these surgical masks don't stop the aerosol transmission of disease. And the aerosol transmission is the very fine particles, not the droplets, but the very fine particles, almost down to the size of an individual viral particle that could flow around in the air. Well, the masks don't stop them. And if you wear a mask for a steady period of time, which a lot of people do, the mask effectiveness starts to go down because it gets saturated. So then you have a mask that has moisture in it, and you start to, when you're breathing through it, now you're still just pushing the viral particles off the end of it. So the masks do not work like they say they do. And I'm afraid, in fact, they've done it. There's a study that says that when people wear masks, they have a tendency to move closer and closer in and to violate social distancing guidelines. So if you're a high-risk person and you're now thinking the mask is going to protect you, perhaps this is leading to people getting infected that wouldn't have gotten infected if they were just kept the social distancing. Frankly, 6 feet of social distancing is better than a mask. So,
well, and Mike, if I can just say, I was in the store yesterday and I saw a lady wearing a mask that said, if you can read this, then you're too close to me and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think we see the incredible hypocrisy of all this when it's okay for 60,000 people to congregate in Houston, or it's not okay for, you know, for the George Floyd Memorial, or it's okay to have an indoor funeral for John Lewis, but it's not okay for a group of Jewish people to have an outdoor funeral. I mean, there's all kinds of unbelievable hypocrisy, and we know, of course, that the political leaders themselves have violated their own rules. And then, like just what you just said, I mean, I saw recently again that video where Fauci is saying, "I don't wear a mask. It's bad, you know. This, it's, you know, they get dirty and all of this." And you're just like, at some point, you know, rational thinking people have to ask ourselves, can we really trust these people that are in charge of something that really is it's obviously a major problem that has to be dealt with. But when they're putting forth this back and forth and not following their own rules and contradicting themselves, it does make it very difficult for the public to trust them.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I mean, right now, given the amount of misinformation, disinformation, and flat-out lies that have come out of health officials, even doctors, and certainly the media, it's very hard to trust these people. Why would you trust them? And here's one of the things that if you really want to get a grasp on this, what you've got to do, and you could do this on Google, if you want to learn something about masks, by the way, there was dozens of studies done on masks prior to February of 2020. Dozens and dozens of studies on masks. So if you really want to understand how masks work prior to the COVID politicization of science and data, or even good studies are basically misportrayed often too, if they're a good study, but we've even had politicized studies, go back there and look at the data, and what you will find is that cloth masks, surgical masks, have either marginal, very little to marginal value, to really no value. And then the other thing you've got to look at is the type of studies they're doing. There's the kind of studies where you go to a lab and you say, we're going to test 10 people, we're going to look at the penetration of the virus through a mask in these clinical conditions, and then they come out and you see these kind of studies all the time on the front pages of the newspapers. Well, these studies may be very true for that very narrow set of circumstances, but even then they might not be true because you might want to get 10 of those types of studies before you say what their conclusion is and that narrow set is true. But they're not true across a large population with hundreds of millions of people wearing masks in all sorts of situations, all different with kids, having to put the kids on the mask on the mask falling on the ground, picking them up. All these things mean that what you want to do is you want to look at a population-based study that actually looks at the actual population of average people wearing masks over an extended period of time and what effect you had. And what you find in that is the masks do not seem to be making a difference. Now, beyond that, beyond the masks, when you get to the lockdowns, not only now that this is even more definite, the lockdowns not only are not stopping the virus transmission, but they're killing far, far more people. A study came out of Canada, and I can't, you know, say that this is true for sure, but this guy claimed it, and he was a published, peer-reviewed medical professional. He said 10 times as many people are being killed by the lockdowns as by the virus. So,
right, and that's what they want to look at. They want to just simply look at the virus itself and not look at, okay, what are the wider societal aspects when it comes to spousal abuse, when it comes to drug abuse, when it comes to suicide, when it comes to education even, and how the education of just you know, simply online does not match in person. I mean, there's so many things. We only want to look at this one thing over here, which really, when it comes to, if we're being honest, I don't trust the CDC data in terms of the number of deaths or the number of cases. I really don't have any idea how many people have gotten COVID. I know a lot of people have gotten COVID, but how many people have died as a result of COVID, we don't even know. They have admitted to us, that if somebody dies and they happen to have COVID, it counts as a COVID death.
Well, the official CDC site itself that lists the official death count, it doesn't have a category died from COVID-19. The category it has is died with COVID-19. So even right there on the official CDC site, they're acknowledging, yes, a whole bunch of people have died with COVID-19. And some of those people include people literally in hospice. There's people that have died with COVID-19. Right. There are people that have died by being in a car accident and being ejected through the window and suffering massive head trauma. They were listed, this was out of Minnesota, listed as dying with COVID-19. But they're listed as COVID-19. But, so you go from the CDC, which says dying with COVID-19, and then you go to the media, and all of a sudden it just becomes, no longer is it dying with COVID-19. The media says dying from COVID-19. And that is absolutely a lie.
Now, what do you think I'd be curious to ask you, because I know you're a numbers guy and you've dug into all of this to such an extent. Why do you think that is? Why do you think they're so interested in bloating the COVID numbers or counting everything as much as they can, at least as a COVID death?
Well, this started off as they were able to use COVID-19 as the camel's nose under the tent to pry open the doors on massive mail ballots. Tens more millions of ballots going out there. So there was a huge political element, and in order to get that through, they had to terrify the populace. And they did succeed in terrifying the populace. They terrified Democrats, they terrified Republicans, and they terrified conservatives. There was a vast majority of the population was very frightened by the way it was portrayed. I mean, remember I'm watching the news broadcasts of the New York City, you know, the trucks, the bodies lining the hall, the frozen bodies being hauled away in gigantic refrigerator trucks. I mean, that's what we saw there, and it terrified people. So they were able to force through and get, and because the people were terrified, the legislators were terrified. And the legislator just rolled over and did anything. And if you opposed something to make it easier to vote, then you wanted people to die. And the legislator said, no, I don't want people to die. So then they voted to open the doors on massive voter fraud. And we saw massive voter fraud this last election cycle. There is no doubt about it. There was over 100,000 affidavits, legally sworn affidavits, and nobody rebutted even one of those in a court of law. That's something that people forget. Those were never rebutted in a court of law. So
right.
None of the evidence was actually rebutted. It was all standing issues, and it was, you know, X after the fat type issues that we had there. So that was it's political, and they see it as also a way. They've been looking for an issue to scare the population into doing what they wanted to do. Now, they were trying to get global warming to do that, and global warming was having some effectiveness in scaring the population into down the road of socialism, things like that. But now they've found this much more effective issue, COVID-19. And I believe that's really what it's at. It is about control. It's about keeping the control, and they've got to keep the fear factor up. So that's why you won't get them to make definitive statements. Basically, when you talk about getting a vaccination, the standard is that you get immunity. That's the standard for disease after disease after disease. For example, let's just talk about that a little bit here. Okay, measles. If you have measles or you get the vaccination, guess what? You get lifelong immunity. Mumps. If you have mumps or you get the mumps vaccination, you will be protected from the mumps for most of your lifetime. A very, very tiny percentage may get a mild case of mumps again, but generally speaking, it's a lifelong immunity. Hepatitis A. If you get hepatitis A, it can be anywhere mild to severe, mostly mild, but that is lifetime immunity. Hepatitis B, you know, minimum of 10 years to lifetime immunity. HPV, human papillomavirus, that's lifetime or 10 years or later. Even influenza, if you get it when you're younger, you have a lifetime of enhanced resistance against any kind of flu virus, even the mutated forms. So we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get back in here. But this is definitely, the science says immunity means something. And when you get it, it counts for at least a season and possibly even greater. And we'll talk about COVID in particular when we get back.
If I tell somebody that not all religions can be right, that if an ancient Eastern religion says that God is a tree and Christianity says, no, God is not a tree. The Bible tells us God made the tree. God and the tree are not the same thing. I say that to students and they don't even see a contradiction. Well, maybe they're both true somehow. Maybe they're both in their own way beautiful. But boy, the minute they find one alleged, supposed contradiction in the Bible, they jump all over it. Old Testament says eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. New Testament says turn the other cheek. Well, if inconsistency is a problem, then it ought to be a problem when we're comparing one religion to another. By the way, the Bible doesn't really have contradictions. People just think that they do. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
And on the show today with you, I have Ryan Holland, and we've been talking a bit about some of the disinformation, misinformation, and outright lies around COVID-19. And we were talking about the idea of immunity. And immunity really is also, you might almost say, I want to say a special case, but there is a spectrum. There's a spectrum of resistance to the disease to what you would qualify as immunity. And you can have a high resistance to the disease and maybe not technically be immune, but you really will have like a weakened version of it. So what happens a lot of times, we'll see with the flu vaccines, is every year they prepare a new set of flu vaccines, and each flu vaccines has, you know, a couple different strains, maybe influenza type A, and then maybe they've got the mainstream influenza type B. And so it's, and some of them have four, but at least three. And they'll give it to people. And what they've done is they've looked at how the virus has evolved over the last year and the strains that seem to be dominant. And they take their best shot, educated guess or estimate. There's a bit of guessing work in it. And they put that in the vaccine and they give it to you. And, you know, we've had the vaccines be as ineffective as 37% up to maybe 75 or 80% in that range. And then older people, they also have to take sometimes bigger doses in order to properly stimulate their immune system to become immune. But when they do miss, what you find, though, is even if they miss and it's not a direct hit on the exact strain, and the strain that really becomes prevalent and the person gets infected with is one that's has genetically drifted away from the one they did the vaccine on, is they still find that people will have much more mild cases of the disease. So even though the vaccine doesn't hit it head on, it gets at least an oblique strike on the disease, and you get a more mild form. What we're finding here is, and this is something that the epidemiologists in this country, anybody that was an epidemiologist knew this. From the onset, any epidemiologist worth their degree, with any knowledge, knew that there was a chance that we would have some innate form of resistance in this country to coronavirus. And the reason that we would have it is because there's the human coronaviruses, which are the cold viruses. There's four or five of those that if you look at them and you see pictures of them, they look identical, almost identical to the SARS-CoV, the coronavirus SARS-2. And now they've done studies that lo and behold show that there is cross-reactivity to people that have had these cold viruses and COVID-19. So what it means is that anywhere from 20, depending on the studies, 20 to 60% of the population has very significant resistance to the coronavirus. And that makes sense because what we're seeing here in this country is a pattern. We're not seeing the pattern of a brand new disease entering a virgin population, say, for example, like smallpox, you know, entering the Indian population, the horrible, awful devastations there. What we're seeing is a different virus but still highly related to other viruses entering a population so that a significant percent of the population has significant resistance. So if you take that significant resistance plus a very strong immune system of a younger person, then you get cases where it doesn't even develop symptoms. We have, you know, maybe 50% asymptomatic. A lot of that comes out of the fact that there was an innate resistance there already built in. And so that's something, but that was never talked about. That was hidden from the population, and it's still being hidden from the population. They've now have several studies strongly suggesting that there is that innate resistance, that resistance, by the way, comes out of the T cell mediated immunity. So let's talk a little bit about that. Probably you've heard the stories about, oh my heavens, 3 months later and all the antibodies are gone. Oh, that's so terrible. They're no longer immune. I guess they need to get that mask on and stay away from everybody. It's just such a horrible thing. Well, that is an outright lie. They're lying to you when you say that, because it's really normal for the antibodies after you've had a disease to diminish and go away after a few months. But what doesn't happen is that the T cells, the memory of how to fight the infection, stays resident in the memory T cells, so that if it comes back into your body rapidly recognizes it, rapidly starts producing those antibodies again, and then you have the killer T cells that just go out and start wiping it out right away. So that even with just the T cell mediated immunity, you never get to the point of even ever showing symptoms. The virus is dead and gone before it even gets to the point of reproducing that level. So the fact that there's no antibodies there doesn't really matter. I mean, it's interesting to know. And obviously, if you get, you know, if you have your body flooded with antibodies, you know, 2 weeks after you got over the disease, the amount of traction the disease is going to get is going to be far less. But you don't need to have that there to have immunity. So with coronavirus, the good news is that unlike the influenza virus, which has significant genetic drift, and I believe the other term is shift, where the variants change enough from season to season to make the body not directly, it's the body kind of recognizes in many cases, but doesn't direct recognize them quite as fast and quite as efficiently. So you get partial resistance. But with the COVID-19 and the SARS-2, you don't get that kind of genetic drift, that kind of mutation. It's not as significant. So the odds are that if you have an immune response, and you have it, and you fight your way through the disease, the odds are that your resistance and your immunity is going to be more significant than the classic for the flu. And what's interesting enough is the SARS-CoV-1. They did studies and they found people that had SARS-CoV-1, which is probably the closest relative to SARS-CoV-2, that 17, 18 years later still had the significant resistance and rapidly were able to build up a fight. So 17 years later. So really the science right now suggests that if you have had COVID-19, by the way, having a disease and fighting through it and coming out the other end, you know, that actually ranges from significantly better than a vaccine to being very comparable to a vaccine. The best vaccines will be comparable to actually having had the disease and fought your way through it, you know, getting through there. And so I can't really say, you know, how the current batch of vaccines compare to actually having COVID-19, but having had the disease and, you know, running its course and being healthy again, that's at least as good as a vaccine.
So well, now they're saying, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but they're saying that even if you've had COVID, you need to get the COVID vaccine. And I know Fauci recently even said, I believe multiple people came out and said that the vaccine itself doesn't even keep you from getting the virus. It just stops the symptoms. So I'm not sure what you've heard or you've read about that, but I was pretty shocked when Fauci came out and said that the vaccine can only help with the symptoms, doesn't actually help with the virus.
I don't believe that's true, because it's an mRNA, and what it does build up the immune system. What they could be saying, and they could be misinterpreted, or maybe they're purposely talking in such a way to be misinterpreted, is that, like any case, is that if you've had it, there could be a period of time where it starts to build up in your system before your immune system kicks back in and fast enough. And that brings up another interesting point, is never in the history of any disease in the world have we done as much testing as we've done with COVID-19. So I believe some of the results we're seeing are artifacts of the amount of testing. For example, you get the flu, and by the way, there's the way they come up with the flu statistics, they don't test that many people for the flu. They look at the symptoms, but the number of tests done for flu are a tiny fraction, and they have like maybe 18 centers across the country where they do a statistical sampling of flu, and that's how they come up with the statistics. Nothing like we're doing right now. So if, because of the amount of testing we're doing, it's possible that, let's say, somebody had SARS-CoV-2 4 months ago. The antibodies are gone. Now they've been reinfected. It's come back into their system, right? And that does, that happens with all types of diseases. It's not like your body has this barrier that stops from entering. It just means your body reacts fast enough to wipe out the disease before it can do any kind of damage whatsoever. So, but this person, so his antibodies have gone away. So now he's depending upon T-cell mediated immunity. And with some of these types of tests, which, you know, multiply effects over and over again, they could definitely end up with false negatives. But in that case, this test is sensitive enough so that it happens to catch the SARS-CoV-2 right before the body's ready to stomp it back into the, but it catches, the test shows positive right before the body full immune system kicks in and knocks it down. And we wouldn't see those kind of effects without a lot of testing, because normally that would happen very fast and you wouldn't see that. But the amount of testing we're doing, it's possible we could see that. So that's happening there. So I was, you know, what set me off is I said, you know, this, I'm talking to my colleague and he's saying 3 months later. Well, where's the evidence for that? Where is the evidence for that? That is purposely meant to keep people frightened. Okay, now, if you've had the disease and you're immune, then you're not a danger to spreading it. You're not a danger to get it. So why are you still wearing a mask? Why?
Hmm.
Well, the mask, right, as I say, a lot of the masking there, I'm not going to say there isn't some scenarios where even a cloth mask or a surgical mask couldn't make sense. I mean, like if you want to be, you know, for some reason you had to be close to somebody talking to them, you know, not having the droplets not landing on you back and forth is probably good. But if you're outdoors and you're walking around, there is zero reason to wear a mask. If you walk by somebody with COVID-19, there's not one documented case of being outdoors and walking by somebody with COVID-19 and getting it. They can't document one case. It's never been documented. That doesn't happen. You don't need to wear the mask when you're in your car. I mean, I guess if you were in the car with somebody that had COVID-19, you know, and then you would probably want to wear a 95 mask, because the normal cloth mask or the surgical mask is not going to stop necessarily the, you know, the aerosol, bioaerosol type transmission. So I believe it's about fear to keep compliance. And Republicans and conservatives and everybody in general, but it's really depressing when you have people that I generally think are more independent thinking, but they've just been bamboozled by this propaganda effort. It is a propaganda effort, and that's as I see it.
It is, and it seems like it's going to go on forever. I mean, at what point are they going to come out and say, no, you no longer have to wear a mask? It doesn't seem like it's anywhere in the next decade. Because I mean, Biden says maybe at the end of this year we can start to change things in that realm. But I mean, we heard that before. At first it was 15 days to stop the spread, and then it was another, what, 45 days or 6 weeks or whatever was after that. And so at some point as a society we have to decide, okay, what are we willing to do, especially when, like when you're talking about, you know, the studies that are out about this, or, you know, the big study out of China. I remember not too long ago coming out about asymptomatic spread and how actually it doesn't happen. It's not this big threat the way that we thought it was. So, I mean, it's like we can mask ourselves to death and we can do it forever. And I just and I agree there are some situations where it can make sense to wear a mask. I mean, you know, obviously just to be able to go in most stores and most places, you have to do so. But it seems as if they're going to want us doing this forever.
Well, it's interesting. So we have this message from Fauci and the public health officials and the elected officials. By the way, I'm going to say this, there's exceptions, but most elected officials, you know, don't know their science from anything. They're not scientists. They're anti-scientists. Okay. They don't know science. They don't know data. They don't know numbers. They can't do simple math. A lot of elected officials. That's not true for all of them. There are doctors who are elected officials and there's other people that are, but generally speaking, give me a break. A study just came out. It's really this January, basically it's showing that 95% of people who recovered from COVID-19 had durable memories of the virus up to 8 months after the infection. Now, that doesn't mean it's only 8 months. It means at least 8 months. So that was 95%. So that's the kind, see, that's what you normally see from a disease, is you see some kind of, you know, and as I said, and even the flu, which was interesting, I just found this out today, is that the flu, if you had the flu when you were a kid, you develop an immunity that's so powerful that even distant strains, many migrations, many mutations, you know, separations down the road, maybe even decades, you still have a strong innate resistance to it. Maybe not immunity, but a resistance. And, so that's actually really, significant there. So we need to get people, I mean, please stop wearing masks when you're walking around the neighborhood on your neighborhood walk. I go to Balboa Park here in town, and, 80, 90% of the people are walking around in bright sunlight, a bright day, wearing a mask in Balboa Park. You just don't need to do that. And especially if you're somebody who, is concerned about personal freedom and things like that, and, your civil rights, you're just contributing to the problem by this compliance, this ridiculous compliance to wear masks where you don't need to wear them. I'm not saying not to wear them when you go visit your, 90-year-old relative that's got, heart disease, but you don't need to wear them a lot of places.
Yeah, and at some point we've got to ask ourselves, what's the bigger picture with the mask? It does seem like the with the left especially, it's more than just health. It's almost like a symbol. It's a symbol of your wokeism. It's a symbol of your submission to the party, if I could be Orwellian for a bit. I mean, it does appear that there is more, and we know that, of course, the Democrat Party has a rich history of mask wearing, if you go back to the Ku Klux Klan. So it seems, and today with Antifa, and now they have surrounding our capital, which looks like it would be out of a dystopian future America. They've got the masked National Guardsmen, thousands and thousands surrounding the capital. It seems like with the masks, there's a bit more there than just simple science, that there's something about the mask that they like.
I totally agree, and we can discuss that further when we get back.
And one of the students said to me, in those Old Testament wars that God commanded, isn't it true that children would have died as innocent casualties? I said to him, yes, but according to the New Testament, when children die at an early age, they go to heaven. And in heaven, they will continue to live with God. In fact, they'll be much better off than they were on earth, living with evil parents who sacrificed babies on altars, as some of those ancient cultures did. Oh, sure, he says, that old cop-out answer. Talking about heaven is a very convenient thing to say. I said to him, friend, when discussing heaven, you must ask yourself what you truly believe. If you don't accept the Bible as being factual when it discusses heaven, why accept the Bible as factual when it discusses war? This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
This is Mike Fredenberg, filling in for Bob Siegel, and on the show today with me is Ryan Holland, and we were just talking about if the possibility that wearing a mask isn't all about public health, that perhaps it means a little bit more. And I think we both know what it means, but Ryan, what do you think it means, wearing the mask?
Well, it seems to be a bit of a status symbol, right? I'm woke. I'm into the cool stuff, and we know what's cool is whatever CNN and MSNBC blurts out. That's what's cool. So I think for a lot of people, it's fairly innocent in the sense that it's a sign of we're with these people over here. But in a wider picture, it does seem to be a sign also of silence and submission. And I think this is really true when you see that, like in California, and I hear out in California, I'm in Texas, by the way, but out in California, that you guys have gotten to over 1.5 million signatures on the Newsom recall, and I think need to get to 2 million just so when they look through them all that they at least have 1.5 million. But when Governor Newsom came out and said that, you can't sing in church, and I'm not just picking on him or California, I know I believe there are other governors that did the same. Even you're in church, you're wearing a mask, but even then you can't sing either. It's the whole thing is weird. But the fact that you're forced to wear a mask in church, it seems like, you know, things are suspect to me when a particular political party promotes a crisis and they get every single thing on the wish list as a result, like what they've tried to do with climate change. And speaking of, I'm here in the North Houston area. We're about to have the second coldest day in our history, but yet AOC and others are telling us in, you know, 12 years the earth is going to melt. But I'm kind of getting off track a little bit there. But I think overall it's a muzzled population. It's a dehumanized population. Some of these masks, when you see them on people, it almost
looks
like
a more isolated population. It creates isolation. It definitely contributes to the sense of isolation. You can't even see. There's studies that show that not being able to see that big, largest portion of the face creates confusion. It diminishes communication effectiveness. There is effects there. So, yeah, absolutely. Now, I do think there's a lot of people out there that because you have to go out of your way to find the good information. It's not like if you go and watch your network news or MSNBC or even Fox, really, you're not going to get the real news. That really, they buy into the argument. And if you want to be caring and compassionate and concerned about your neighbor, it's not necessarily about you not getting it. It's about you not giving somebody else. And people really do believe that way. So there is good intentions out there with people wearing masks as well. And so but there is definitely, it is definitely a submission compliance symbol as well. I mean, it's you know, I don't want to, you know, everybody out there's got to, you know, analyze their own selves as to where they fall on that spectrum. But definitely the science right now shows that, you know, is not at all telling us that masks are this silver bullet. It's showing that it's, you know, at best this tiny effect or very no effect when you look across the entire population. With that said, there are some cases that make sense, logical sense, where you would wear one. But please, folks, you don't need to wear them when you're walking outside. You don't need to wear them in your car by yourself. There's a lot of places you just don't need to wear them. They don't do anything. The science does not support that. And so with that said, let's move on to a little bit of a different topic, which I think you had mentioned to me that you're interested in. We're totally flipping topics here to talk about hate speech in Scotland. And you have a little to give us an update on that. What's going on there?
Yeah. So I do a podcast called World News Brief. It's on the CGM Radio Network. So you can find it at cgmradio.com. And so, of course, I pay attention to world news from here and there, but I think actually this is somewhat connected, right? We were just talking about a muzzled population or a population, especially when a population that's outside wearing masks. It definitely doesn't look like a free population. So, you know, here in America, we don't have specific laws against hate speech, and it's for good reason. Number one, speech is protected in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And number two, how would you even then define what that hate speech is? It's basically the group in power telling everyone that disagrees with them, if you say anything we don't like, we're gonna send you to jail. We're gonna punish you in some way. But in Scotland, so interesting, there was a plan in England and Wales to criminalize hate speech, even in private homes. That plan has been dropped in England and Wales. However, the plan is actually still pending in Scotland. Now, the big red flag that should come off right away is, why are there hate speech laws at all, you know, even outside of the private home? Again, and personally, I don't like hate speech. I don't like being hateful toward my neighbor, but if you look at, you know, the regarding issues such as same-sex marriage and transgenderism, what they're basically telling you is that you can't even share what the scripture or what the Bible says. And we're going to get to what the atheist group in Scotland says about that in just a minute. But so they're wanting to actually, still in Scotland, they dropped it in England and Wales, but in Scotland, they want to actually criminalize speech in your home. Now, Scotland is a very socialist nation, so I think that's important to keep that in the back of our minds. But it's amazing. Like the think tank Civitas noted that every aspect of people's lives will come under legal scrutiny in order to promote a set of state-sanctioned values that have been determined by lawyers rather than voted on by the electorate. Christian groups are concerned. There was one individual, though, I noted this was in a great article from WorldNet Daily, but there was one individual who, he is the Cabinet Secretary for Justice. His name is Humza Harun Yousaf. His parents came to Scotland as immigrants from Pakistan and one other country, I forget which one, in the 1960s. And he basically said that he is demanding that also that hateful speech in homes be criminalized. And his plan would allow journalists and theater directors even to face charges if what they write is perceived as deliberately stoking prejudice. Now, the question I think that's important to ask, okay, who is this Humza Harun Yousaf? Well, he was the media spokesman for the Islamic Relief Worldwide, which is a charity that has been accused on a number of occasions as being a front group for radical Islamists. So, and if you dig into that, the Gatestone Institute did a very good report on this, where Islamic Relief Worldwide, which he actually has worked, this guy Yousaf has worked with since he was 10. They're connected to Hamas. Islamic Relief Worldwide has received funding from Al-Qaeda, charity donations from Al-Qaeda, connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, and a whole bunch of other bad actors. And so, and I'll say one more thing, the atheist group, Atheist Scotland in the UK, said that the atheists see merit in the proposed hate crime and public order bill for Scotland. He said this will enable the prosecution of all Scotland's religions and their holy books for spreading hatred. That's an incredible statement. And then he said this. He said, we fully intend to monitor all holy books, sermons and places of worship, and the social media accounts of the various religions and report any hatred to police Scotland for criminal investigation. So here you have this marriage of this Islamist, this flat-out Islamist who's a politician there in Scotland, and the atheist group. And who are they going to be coming against? They're coming against Christians, even in their private homes. And I saw this, and I wanted to bring it to our attention that this is what is the full flowering, the full blossoming of leftism. That's what it is. And you're like, how do atheists and how do Muslims come together? They do it all the time. They do it here in the U.S. They did it in Iran. They do it throughout the world. And they do it for a season, but it doesn't usually end well for the atheists. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to comment on that, Mike.
No, it does seem like an unholy alliance that in the end is probably not going to work out. It's not the dynamics don't give us a strong sense of confidence in how long this partnership is going to last. Because if you talk about the atheists and hate speech, certainly, you know, traditional Islam, you know, is pretty strong on areas like homosexuality and things like that. So right. It's just going to be, it's a very interesting topic. So I think it'd be worth looking back at that too. Next time we do a show, we'll take a look at the demographics in Europe and Holland that might be driving that there. Well, but I did want to cover, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
But I did want to get to a couple things just because they're timely. And this subject's been going on for a while is, you know, we had 7 U.S. senators vote to convict Donald Trump. And I just want to briefly name who they are and give a status on their, you know, in terms of whether they're, you know, how soon they have to face re-election or election. So we've got Richard Byrd out of North Carolina. Well, he courageously said he was going to vote to convict Donald Trump, and he's retiring in 2022. So he's going out. Bill Cassidy, Louisiana, just was re-elected. So he's got 6 years before he's up for re-election. Then we got Susan Collins. She's up for 6 years before she faces re-election. Lisa Murkowski now, she's the exception. She's up for re-election in 2022, and I don't believe she's ever gotten a majority of the vote in Alaska. So she could really, that actually might actually have a little bit of courage in her vote there. I don't know. Potentially. Mitt Romney, he's up for re-election in 2024. Ben Sasse is up for re-election in 2027. And then we got Pat Toomey, who voted to convict, who's retiring as well in 2022. So I just think that we really obviously want to be going after these people in the primaries as much as we can. But many of them, obviously, as U.S. senators, they've got, you know, they have these massive six-year terms. And they're supposed to be, you know, right, we don't like this vote, but they're supposed to be able to vote against the populist vote over any given period of time to sort of act as a break upon what the House might be doing. Right, because the House every 2 years they can, you know, get almost the mob rule can almost, even though that does mitigate that, it's not a pure democracy, it's more closer to that. So this is one of the balancing functions. But we had seven people vote, and I can tell you though there was not a constitutional case to have the impeachment in the first place. There was no due process. It was ridiculous process in the House to do the impeachment. So even if you thought it was constitutional to impeach somebody who already left office, to impeach the president specifically who's left office, the idea that there was anything even resembling due process in the House and you would support it in any way, shape, or form, no Republican, no Democrat should have, but no Republican should have done that. And then to have Mitch McConnell come out afterwards and say, you know, that President Trump was responsible for the insurrection, you know, We have some issues here in the party. We've got to work really hard.
And Mitch McConnell as well is one of those brave senators who just won re-election off of Trump's coattails. And so he's got 6 years before right. He has to face the electorate again.
So just in the last minute or two here, you know, we sit here, and I know many people out there listening have been very frustrated and maybe even a bit frightened, because, frankly, if you're not frightened, you're not paying attention, okay, with what we've seen, the massive censorship, the mass application of state power. It's been frightening. But here's some things we can do. One of the things I'm going to say is that they've been trying to demonize the idea that if you're a part of being a Trump supporter or a populist or, heaven forbid, a MAGA person, that you're a terrorist. And I think that's had an effect. So what I'm going to just say is, you know, keep situational awareness around you. Always be situational aware. Be careful. But don't let them have you make you stop wearing your MAGA hat. Wear your MAGA hat, and because that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it so that you're ashamed to wear a MAGA hat. Don't let them do that to you. Okay, then that's one thing. Give to organizations like Judicial Watch, which has an ongoing project to clean up the voter rolls. Give to organizations like the Thomas More Society, which is funded the Amistad Project, which was on the front lines of uncovering voter fraud. And then get involved with your local party. We don't have time to talk about this yet, but I personally don't believe in a complete separate third party. I believe in a movement that's affiliated with the Republican Party, like the Tea Party has been, or maybe the MAGA movement. Get involved with local politics, because a grassroots effort can overcome money every time. I've been involved with campaigns, many campaigns, where we've been outspent and we won because we had the grassroots. So it can be done. Just because they've got the money on their side doesn't mean they're going to win. And then we can have a little bit of hope that maybe the Supreme Court, now that the election's over and the pressure's not as much on them, that they actually will come out with some rulings that will be beneficial in 2022. And that's, you know, kind of where we're at, is we need to be active, and we need to not let them label us. And we cannot act like we're the people they say they are. We are the ones that are following the laws. We're the ones that aren't, that support the rule of law and the Constitution. They're the ones who have been gutting it, and we need to stand up and not let them silence us.
So yeah, with that said, without a doubt. Yeah, and the media will lie constantly about us, so ignore them.
Yeah, so with that said, I just want to thank Ryan for being on tonight with me. Great show. Thank you, Ryan. And
absolutely.
Thanks, Bob Siegel. Bob Siegel's show for, you know, allowing me to sit in for the night. Very awesome. And with that, I think we're going to call it for the evening, and turn it back over to Brendan.
The Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.